It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 12/3 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
And a lot of people say, well, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or I didn't have trauma, or my childhood was fine, or, you know, no, the trauma is these other people with these big events, and they don't label it as such. And, you know, for me, I don't care what you call it, but your brain and your body are going to do the same thing anyway. Right. So, you know, that's why I like to say all of us have trauma. We can call it whatever you want to, you know, but a lot of people will dismiss their experience, or they'll minimize their experience because it doesn't fit that mold of what they thought a real trauma was.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to make sure I said that, because a lot of people will dismiss or invalidate their experiences because they don't have a concept of, hey, all of these death by a thousand tiny cuts will still make you bleed out.
Welcome to Settling is Bullshit, a sweary podcast about claiming your joy. If you are an adult human craving healthier boundaries, a greater sense of purpose, or an increased capacity to feel at ease in your own skin, then you are in the right place, my friend. I'm your host, Kate Blauk, and I'm here to offer you practical tools and playful encouragement to help you step forward and be your most awesome self. My hope is that each episode will leave you feeling a bit more empowered to make brave choices and claim your joy.
Oh my goodness, y'all. I'm so excited to have this conversation today for a variety of reasons, one of which is the human that I am getting to have this conversation with. She's amazing. I'm here with Dr. Stephanie Goldsmith, licensed clinical psychologist, associate clinical professor, director of a big fancy psychology thing that I can never say right. Steph, what is it called?
It's called Gestalt Associates Training Los Angeles. We're a psychotherapy training program. We're actually the longest running international psychotherapy training program in the world.
Oh my, see, it's amazing. So she's a really big deal, y'all. I don't know if you picked up on that. She's also a big deal to me because she's one of my best friends from college. So there's just like so much yumminess in this conversation for me. Dr. Goldsmith is here to talk to us about the relationship between trauma and joy, which is so important because trauma interrupts joy. And I want us all to live really joyful lives. And I think Steph does too.
Indeed. I think the relationship is, it's interesting. It can be bidirectional, right? So there are two concepts that are on the end of the same spectrum. So trauma can interrupt your ability to get to joy, but I think it actually does so in a well-intentioned way. Okay. So, or I should say the trauma response does. So once somebody has integrated a trauma response and they get triggered in the future, that's what can interrupt your joy, but it's doing so in a well-meaning way. It's not trying to make your life difficult. It's actually trying to help you out.
Okay. There's so many things here. Okay. So trauma is not trying to interrupt my life.
It is, but it's doing so in a well-intentioned manner.
Okay. So trauma has a good, whoa. Let's start with what is trauma?
Sure. It's actually a very amorphous term that a lot of people have a difficulty defining and explaining. And trauma is very much on a spectrum.
Okay.
So all of us have trauma. There's itty bitty little traumas that we experience every day. And then we have these really big, what we would call a single incident trauma or a big T trauma. That is one of these big incidents is like a car crash or a sexual assault or something like that.
Yeah, so, I think for me, for a long time, like that's what I thought trauma was. And so when I was going through my personal journey of figuring my shit out, you know, I didn't have a like big event to point to. So I was like, oh, I don't have anything. But what has been incredibly helpful for me is recognizing that I had quite a bit of like less big T trauma. and I think that's a common experience, right?
It's definitely a common experience. And that's why I like to say everybody has traumas. Mm-hmm. They just impact our lives differently. So what some people call complex trauma or little T trauma, this is what I like to describe as that death by a thousand tiny cuts, where, you know, maybe one little incident is something that upsets us, but we move on. But it's a cumulative effect of having a lot of these incidences over time. So that can be many, many different things. It could be abuse or neglect in childhood over a period of time by a trusted caregiver. We can look at racialized trauma, where we see a lot of microaggressions or even kind of overt racism and overt oppressive actions. And those are traumatic, especially over time cumulatively. We can see that it really triggers a stress response and it can have a huge health impacts on people. Mm-hmm. They can really affect their health outcomes. So trauma is one of these big terms. It can be these kind of cumulative smaller incidences, or it can be one of these really major life events that there's it cleaves your life, right? Before and after this big event that happened. So I think that's why a lot of people have difficulty defining it, because it can be many different things, but all of us have incidences of trauma. It just depends a lot on how big the incidences are, how long it happened for, at what point in our development it occurred. So all of these things can have different impacts on people. And then, of course, the person's individual experience, their resilience, their resources, their family system, et cetera, can also impact how they recover or don't recover from trauma.
Yeah. So we all experience traumas. Some have kind of a bigger impact on how we are able to show up in the world than others. How do we determine kind of when trauma is showing up in our lives later down the road? What does that look like?
Many different things. And sometimes the symptoms aren't as obvious. And I think, I want to answer something you actually said a minute ago before I forget to, is you were talking about how sometimes people don't know to label some of their experiences as trauma because they think of it as the car crash or the sexual assault or the natural disaster or being in a war zone or some of these more stereotypical definitions. It's very, very common in my work as a certified clinical trauma professional. So I see a lot of trauma cases in my practice. And a lot of people say, well, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or I didn't have trauma, or my childhood was fine, or, no, the trauma is these other people with these big events, and they don't label it as such. And, for me, I don't care what you call it, but your brain and your body are going to do the same thing anyway. Right. So, that's why I like to say all of us have trauma. We can call it whatever you want to, but a lot of people will dismiss their experience or they'll minimize their experience because it doesn't fit that mold of what they thought a real trauma was. And some people have traumas that are so early and ongoing that they don't really have words around it. We call that pre-verbal trauma. So they still think, I don't have something to hang my hat on. I don't have something to point to and say, this is the reason why I do that.
Yeah.
So, I wanted to make sure I said that, because a lot of people will dismiss or invalidate their experiences because they don't have a concept of, hey, all of these death by a thousand tiny cuts will still make you bleed out. Like it will
Oh my God, 100%. Like, and that was my experience, right? Of just not having a big event to point to and then getting into therapy in adulthood and being like, why the fuck is this happening to me? Why am I showing up this way? What is going on? And then eventually realizing it was like, oh, because like I was overweight as a kid and was like really heavily bullied at school. And my big brother was really mean to me. And that had a fucking impact on my capacity to be in the world and be okay in my own skin and be in my body. And it turns out that's trauma.
Yes, absolutely. That is absolutely valid trauma. So, and if you think about it, developmentally, when you're a child and these repeated instances are going on, that's how your brain and your nervous system learn how to interact in the environment. So that's where your brain and your body is starting to adapt towards these are the rules. This is how I can shortcut to act faster. Because our brains are actually really lazy. They want to do shortcuts as fast as possible. The sooner you can kind of make something procedural, the more effective you can be to move on to the next adaptive learning. Uh-huh. So if you're learning something about yourself, oh, you're unlikable, you're too fat, you're unappreciated in your family system, you're the wrong size, you're the wrong gender, you're the wrong color, whatever these things are, that becomes automated into your brain and your nervous system.
Oh yeah.
So that, that becomes truth, that stops being checked out. It becomes automatic and your brain will adapt to that. So when you have these kinds of traumas, you are looking out for safety and danger. So now your brain is orienting around vigilance. So if you have consistent chaotic environment when you're a kiddo, you're now going to be orienting to the external world more than being curious about your internal world. Folks who grow up in secure attachment where they are valued and maybe bad things happen, but they're, you know, families and their social systems are still really wrapping around them and caring for them. They might say bad things happen, but I'm still okay. I'm still a good person. For people who have chaotic environments and unsupported caregivers and this kind of stuff, you know, they really learn to orient outside about whether or not they're okay. They come home and they hear loud noises and they say, dad's drinking again. I had better go to my room. I better hide. I better leave and go to my friend's house. So they become more vigilant to the outside world. And the why that matters is because as they grow up, they've now learned in order to stay safe and in order to regulate myself, I need to be more attentive to the outside world rather than curious about myself and my needs. So they don't really learn to regulate what's going on inside themselves and to learn, you know, what their desires are, what their path, there's no room for that when you're consistently monitoring for safety.
Oh, okay. So would you say that's kind of one of the key components of trauma response, being in trauma response, is being just really outwardly oriented and not as able to sort of turn inward and access kind of what's going on in my own system?
Yes, more externally oriented, more, you know, attending to that stimuli. And that's why a lot of folks who have especially complex PTSD, which is that kind of developmental trauma, it's why they don't have great memories either from when they're kids, which I hear a lot from people. I don't remember that much from before I was like 11 or 12. I'm like, well, if you were learning to kind of externally orient and look for safety, your brain doesn't have all those resources then to code what we call mundane memories. Like when I was 7 years old, I did a lemonade stand with my friends is a mundane memory. And it's not going to code as much because your brain is using so many more resources to adapt around a chaotic environment.
Oh, wow. I'm so glad we're having this conversation. My body just like relaxed hearing that explanation of just like, oh my God, this makes so much sense. So, okay, that's kind of what trauma is, how it happens. And then we get to adulthood. And then how does that kind of tend to impact how we show up in the world? What's going on? What's the through line there?
Well, if this person who's now grown up, who's now learned to orient towards safety and danger, there's less room for feeling safe in relationships. Think about adapting yourself around, how do I make sure that I don't get hurt?
Yeah. You know, oof.
Right.
And I'm familiar with that one.
So you see this a lot with damaged attachment relationships in adulthood, because especially if the abuse or the neglect or the chaos came from a primary caregiver when you're younger, we are hardwired to attach. We want to find primary attachment figures. And we're looking for that. So we're hardwired to do that. But the person whose ability to do that has now been interrupted by maltreatment in some way. There's, I want to attach to you. And that feeling of attachment is also now paired with, and I get hurt. So you see people who, I want a relationship, I want a partner, I want these kinds of things, and I'm terrified that I'm going to be abandoned, I'm going to be hurt, I'm going to be left. And they sometimes internalize a message of, I am leavable, I am not lovable, you know, I'm a person who, you know, gets abused, something about me, you know, led to this. So there's a lot of like guilt and shame that comes along with that kind of upbringing. So it's harder to feel entitled to love and entitled to attachment with a partner or friends or, you know, any close attachment relationship, because now there's that automatic learned belief of, this is how I exist in the world. This is the treatment that I'm expecting.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is why a lot of people also kind of repeat abusive relationships, because it's not abstract for them.
Right. There's this degree of kind of, as you were saying, our brain built that shortcut that this is what love is. This is how
I can expect to be treated.
Yeah. How I can expect to be treated. And I just wanted to underline something you said about like not feeling entitled to love. Oh, my heart just hurts and also is so familiar with that story. I think that certainly describes my experience and a lot of people's experiences of, you know, getting to adulthood, really yearning for connection and love, and having this just underlying sense of, there's something wrong with me, it doesn't work for me, I'm broken, etc. And this is where I put in a giant plug for therapy. Because
me too, but I'm biased.
I mean, I'm not a therapist, but also I have reaped tremendous benefits from doing work in therapy around that trauma, around that ache, around that wounding. And the glorious thing is I can say I'm on the other side of it, like, thanks to therapy. And so I guess my next question is, yeah, what does working with that look like from your professional perspective? You know, I've been on the other end of it, but how would you describe or explain, like, what needs to happen to really process trauma in the sense that, like, I went to talk therapy for a long time and it really helped me redirect my thinking and, you know, get clear on a lot of my patterns, but it didn't do the hardwiring, rewiring stuff. And so it wasn't until I have experience with EMDR that has worked really well for me. But I'd love to hear you, Steph, talk about, like, what trauma therapy specifically is and what it's doing that is different and important and valuable and wonderful and magical, and everybody should do it.
Well, you know, I feel like I want to plug therapy too, not just as a therapist, but as a person who's been a client, you know, on and off for many years. It's been so healing for me to have done my own work, and it also boosts my ability to be a really present therapist. I don't think you can take anybody further than you've gone yourself. So for me, it's almost like a mandate that I need to be on top of my own mental health and my own recovery so that I can be an available, present, you know, processed through person that I'm sitting across from other people while they're working through their stuff. So
yeah, I love that. You can't take anybody further than you've been yourself. That's so true. It shows up in my coaching, certainly, and my recovery and 12-step program. Like, that's how that's kind of built, is that you go through the steps and then you can take people through the steps.
Same idea. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm biased, but my thought is, like, I don't know if I'd want to see a therapist who hadn't done their own work. I mean, that's my bias. Yeah. So when I've gone to therapy, I've actually asked that question, you know, before I booked an appointment, you know, like, hey, this is really important to me. Have you done your own work too? And, you know, the anybody who gets defensive about that, they're not a good match for me. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that.
But that's, okay. You know, but I explain my personal bias for that reason. But so trauma work is the way that it's different. I think good trauma work, the way that it's different is you're using the whole person's experience to help them heal. There's some therapies out there that are very what we call top down, meaning go from your cognitions and your intellectual processes and try to change what's happening in your body. I don't love that approach. I think it has its uses, but I think it's very limited. I think you have to use what are called bottom-up approaches, meaning that you are using the somatic bodily experiences and the emotional experiences to inform your cognition, even though it's kind of a bidirectional thing where they inform each other. We know that we get a lot of information from our bodies. And it feels like, at least in this culture in the United States, we really prize cognition, intellect, things like
yeah.
that. We ignore our body sense and we ignore our emotions. And
totally.
For me, that's a huge problem, because why would you cut off any mode of information? So our emotions are actually, like, evolutionarily built to inform us about what is important to us, what we don't like, what we want to avoid, what we want more of. I mean, think about it. If you like something, you usually move towards it and want more of it. If you don't like something, you ignore it or you back away. So
Right.
And that's just the basic. Yeah. I like or
cucumbers,
I don't like something.
I move the fuck away from cucumbers. I hate them. They're vile.
Cucumbers.
But, like, put a, like, yummy piece of chocolate pie in front of me. I'm gonna move toward that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to be fair, like, my body does not like cucumbers, and I honor and respect that.
So you're doing something that we would call, like, it's a really adaptive, you know, it has an adaptive function to it. I don't like cucumbers, so I don't eat it. Uh-huh. But how many times do people talk themselves out of their emotion because they should do something else?
Oh my God, I just got goosebumps, right? Of like, oh, I'm crying. I shouldn't be crying. I'm going to stop crying.
Right. And that's a message you picked up somewhere, right? The message is probably, I shouldn't cry because I look weak. I shouldn't cry because I'm in a female presenting body and the world won't take me seriously because I'm crying. Yeah. Or I can't, you know, all these messages that we have around what we should and shouldn't do, they can interrupt our ability to actually get our needs met in a way that's healthy and informative. So with trauma work, the trauma response is actually adaptive. And I'm going to go back to that whole, it interrupts with good intention.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I'm going to go back to that. So when you are triggered in trauma, so if somebody's in my office, there's no immediate trauma, you know, there's nothing going on, but they might get triggered and their body and their emotions and their cognitions might all react based on a trauma trigger to orient their body towards something, fight, flight, freeze, appease, you know, any of these big responses that trauma will have you do. And those are the big trauma responses, fight, flight, freeze, and appease.
And so just because I feel like the word trigger is now all over the place. And what I'm picking up that I just wanted to kind of pull out and highlight is that a trauma trigger is when our nervous system gets activated into one of those responses you just described, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So remember, we've now got people who have a trauma history, they now have more vigilance to their external environment. So what we would call, some people would call that hypervigilance, depending on how, you know, attentive it is. So if you now have a certain amount of your attention, of your brain power is orienting to the external environment, and it picks up on some blip that is indicative of the trauma that you've suffered, it's going to try to protect you by orienting you to some kind of arousal, fight, flight, freeze, appease. So it's going to orient you. So now like, oh, there's something happening here that's similar to what happened back there. Now you need to attend to it.
Yeah.
So if I'm talking with somebody and we're having a conversation in therapy or we're doing therapy and I notice that they stiffen or I notice that they do something, I'm going to ask what just happened. And I'm going to have them attend to what's going on in their body, what's going on in their emotions, and what's going on in their thoughts so that they can start to learn, oh, this is what my body does in response to this set of conditions. The thing is, our brain, it doesn't pinpoint specific conditions, right? So the area of our brain is our limbic system. That's where a lot of the trauma response happens. I mean, it happens in a lot of the brain, but I'm going to try not to do too much of the neuroscience for this podcast.
Yeah, my eyes just went like, okay, I know that word.
it's the midbrain region where our memory centers are and our kind of emotion detector. Uh-huh. It's called the amygdala. Like it's this part of our brain that really attends to some of these kind of environmental and emotional cues. And when it's a trauma response, it doesn't go back to mundane memory where you're like, oh, what's that? And you get curious about it. It goes to a much faster response so that you can orient faster. And if you think about that, that's a really good response if you're actually in danger.
Right.
So the classic example is the veteran who comes back from war and you know, they're living their normal life and all of a sudden it's 4th of July and the fireworks start going off and they hit the deck, right? They have that immediate response. And even though they might know it's not gunfire, the smell, the sound, the boom, like vibration in the body has enough similarity that your limbic system says, act as if your life is on the line. So the limbic system is coming in, your brain is coming in, and it's giving you those cues to act as if you are in danger right now. And if you think about it, that's actually really adaptive because if there was a gunshot, they're more readily available to act than somebody who says, what's that sound? So there's actually a survival aspect to it that's really beneficial. So your nervous system is actually trying to help you out here. It's like the last time that smell, that sound, that vibration happened, you almost died. So I'm going to take away that extra second that you have to start to be curious, and I'm going to put you immediately into action mode.
Yeah. So what's an example of then how that translates to those of us who haven't been in a war zone, who haven't been in the car accident? What's our, like,
Like, what does that look like? What's that look like with like complex trauma versus like the.
Yeah. Right. Because, you know, I would read that, like, I would read The Body Keeps the Score. And I'm just like, I don't relate to this because, like, I'm not a veteran. What are you talking about? So, yeah. What's the kind of everyday tender-hearted human walking around in the world who hasn't had that? How does this show up for us? I will include myself in that.
Okay, I can give you some examples. This has actually come up a lot with people who have attachment trauma. They go out on a date and somebody starts, you know, you look really nice. You're really pretty. I want to hold your hand. And then the person has a response or a disgust response or a, why would you want to hold my hand? You don't know me. And the immediate response is one of some kind of aversion. It can be disgust. It can be fear. It can be disturbance. It can be anger. You know, that response isn't what we normally think of as an adaptive response to somebody sincerely saying you look nice or I want to hold your hand.
Right.
But because there's some sense of pairing of maltreatment with somebody giving you affectionate attention, that's what that can look like.
Yeah.
So that's an example. I mean, I can give you many examples.
Right. No, I mean, I think that one's pretty relatable.
Well, another big one that a lot of people go, oh my gosh, I never thought of it that way, is people who have damaged attachment. Again, when they actually meet somebody who treats them really well and that is really sweet and really attentive, they feel bored. They feel bored. They feel suspicious. And it's because their nervous system is so ready for the fight or so ready that they can't read this as like, this person genuinely actually just likes me and there's no catch.
Yeah.
So that they can actually feel very boring or very confusing for somebody who's grown up in a very chaotic primary attachment relationship.
Yeah. So in that example, I think this is a lovely segue to what we're, you know, excited to talk about the relationship between trauma and joy and the idea that that interruption, that response is, you know, is well-intentioned. So build that bridge for me of like, okay, like my little trauma response, like there's this person who's treating me well and is nice to me and I'm bored. What is the trauma response's intention and like, what do we do with that?
I like to do something called parts work in my therapy. And basically it's like, we all have kind of different parts of ourselves that hold different feelings and needs. And it's actually a really great way to conceptualize trauma and not even just trauma, like experiences in general.
Yeah.
But I'm going to just say like the part of you that holds trauma, like the trauma part is basically trying to, it's almost like tapping you on the shoulder and saying like, we don't know what this response is. Like, can you trust that this person's actually being nice to you? And so the interruption that interrupts you from joy with good intention is either we've been here before and you need to attend to this information, or I don't know what this is and I don't know how to react and I'm scared. So it interrupts you to pay more attention to it or to be suspicious of it because it doesn't want you to get hurt again. So its intention is there's enough in this environment. There's some kind of set of conditions here that's familiar enough to when you've been hurt or is unknown enough that it's confusing, that it's drawing your attention to that to make you be more cautious or withdrawn or to act. So, you know, just like even that really classic example with the veteran with the fireworks, the idea here is there's enough similarity in the set of conditions that I'm going to completely interrupt your life so that you attend to it so that we keep you safe and you stay alive. Even though that reaction is overblown, it's not what's needed. It's no longer adaptive.
Right.
But it's trying to protect you from harm, whether it's actual harm like gunfire or it's emotional harm like attachment trauma. So its intention is to keep you safe. Its intention is to, you know, warn you about a set of conditions that's reminiscent of where you've been hurt before. But the problem is trauma memories become static. They get really stuck. They become immutable and you can't talk yourself out of it. That's why a lot of people say, I know I'm safe. I know that this person isn't dangerous, but my body's still hijacked.
Yeah.
It's because you can't talk yourself out of it. You have to work with the somatic sense and you have to work with the emotional sense, which is why EMDR is super effective. And there's other Yeah, and so I also do folks EMDR. Who don't, yeah.
Yeah, so for folks who don't know what EMDR is, what is it?
It's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. You never need to know that again.
Right.
But yeah. It uses the body's natural rhythms to process trauma. So the idea behind it is, have you ever gone to bed upset? Like you've had a bit of an argument with a friend or something, and then you wake up the next morning and you're like, I don't know what that was about. Let me call them and make up. I feel better. Like the day's better.
Yes.
Your brain does a lot of processing.
Specific example. My brain was a shitty neighborhood last night, like because I didn't sleep well. I like, you know, hermited up too much, didn't have enough human contact, was like in a gunky place. And then I woke up this morning and I was like, oh, actually, life's pretty great. I'm in a good mood. I'm going to talk to one of my favorite people this morning. Like things are fine.
That is a perfect example. And by the way, I love that I'm one of your favorite people. You're one of mine.
Oh my God, you so are.
We've known
I don't know if I already said this, but like Steph is one of my oldest friends and one of the people I consider a like chosen family sister. So there's that.
Same. Yeah. My kids call her auntie. You know? Like,
yeah.
We've known each other for I think over 20 years at this point. Yeah, over 20 years.
Yeah.
So yeah. About something oh like that. God. Yeah. So it's been a long
around
time.
In the vicinity of two decades. In the Jesus Christ. I feel old, but it's great. This is the beauty of aging is you get to be friends with people for 20 years. Okay. So anyway, I woke up in a better place this morning and you were about to explain why.
Because when you sleep, your brain does a bunch of stuff. I mean, that's why we actually need sleep. It processes a bunch of things. It clears a bunch of gunk out. Like it does a lot of really important things while you're sleeping. And we have the idea behind EMDR is we have rapid eye movement when we're sleeping and EMDR mimics that. So traditional EMDR does eye movements back and forth. But now we know that you don't have to just do eye movements. You can do any kind of what's called bilateral stimulation. So that's tapping on both sides of the body or listening to music, you know, through both ears, alternating back and forth. But the idea is you're alternating back and forth to do what's called bilateral stimulation. And that calms down the nervous system. And we're realizing we've been doing this intuitively, like throughout the span of human existence. When you watch a parent with their baby, they sway back and forth. That's bilateral stimulation. People go for a run. They feel a lot better. Guess what that is? That's bilateral stimulation. You know,
but, God, I didn't think about that.
Right. When people do drum circles and they love drum circles. And guess what drumming is? Bilateral stimulation. So we do all these. Yeah. We already do. Naturally, we do a lot of stuff that's bilateral stimulation. And even without thinking about it, it's something that we do to soothe our nervous system rhythm. So that's what EMDR does is it uses bilateral stimulation. So you create a trauma. There's a lot to it. I mean, you do a lot of resourcing beforehand, which is.
Yeah, this is not. Don't try this at home.
Don't try this at home. No, please go see.
There are lots of licensed professionals.
Go see a trained therapist if you're going to do EMDR. But, you know, there's a lot of resourcing and preparing people to do EMDR. But the actual reprocessing is you create a trauma script. And what I like about it is it really does take the whole body into consideration. You know, what's the emotion? How disturbing is it? What's the sensation in your body? What's the belief, you know, the cognition? So it's really looking at the whole experience, which I think is really important. And then you create a trauma script and then you do bilateral stimulation. And what it does is it helps reprocess trauma that has otherwise become stuck. So it works with that part of the brain that's really hard to access just with cognitions. It works using, you know, a full body experience. So I think that's why, you know, it's a really useful trauma therapy. And then there's other great trauma therapies that aren't just talk therapy. There's something called brain spotting. There's something called EFT tapping, which is emotion freedom techniques. All of these use the brain and the body's natural system. Like we're actually working with our biology to help treat trauma. You know, I think all these things should be in conjunction with talk therapy because it can, you know, it can be really interesting. You're like rewiring your nervous system so it can feel really vulnerable and it can feel really weird.
And like, you know, you need to talk about it afterwards. Totally.
Right.
You know, I'm curious. So hearkening back, so The Body Keeps the Score is the name of a very famous book about trauma. You're talking about like the way in which processing trauma involves really bringing bodily experience into it. What does it mean that trauma is stored in the body or the body keeps the score?
It's because it's not just, it's not an intellectual pursuit. It's a felt sense pursuit. It's, you know, it's coded in your brain. It's coded in your nervous system. You know, we're adaptive beings. So the way that our bodies adapt to our environment has to do with the stimuli in our environment. So, you know, a lot of times when people get triggered, it's visceral. You know, people will feel, when I do trauma work with people, whether it's EMDR or, you know, some of the Gestalt talk therapy that I do or some of these other protocols that I do, you know, I often check on the body and people get sensations in their chest, in their stomach, in their hands, in their feet. And when I ask them to check that out, even if they don't have a concrete memory, they have a sense of, I have a feeling of wanting to hide, or I notice that I want to run, or, you know, there's something happening in my shoulders and they make me want to hunch and get smaller. And it's like your body will tell you a lot about trauma. So I've even had people act out those bodily imperatives, I guess, you know, people who want to hide, which is very common for folks who have trauma when they're really, really young, because when you think about what little kids can do, they don't have that many resources to protect themselves. They can pretend to be asleep. They can hide. You know, there's not much they can do, which, by the way, sometimes people fall asleep during trauma therapy too, because it's triggered. And that was what they did.
Interesting.
Right? Like that was their coping. But that was their coping skill when the trauma was built. So that's what their nervous system remembers. But I've had people hide in my office. You know, I have pillows and things like that. And, you know.
And that's a part of
Gestalt.
Gestalt.
Yeah.
Specifically. I'd love to, you know, bring forward a little bit, like, what makes that type, like, that therapeutic approach
so effective,
unique, or what it is.
I think because it's so experiential, it's not always an intellectual therapy. It's very experiential. It's, you know, how do you attend to your body process, what we call your phenomenology, how you experience the world? How do you attend to that in a way to get more information, to become aware of what your needs are, so that you can act in a more adaptive way? Adaptive to your age, your needs now, because a lot of times we are acting in the here and now based on rules that were built in the there and then. So we're doing stuff that we learned back then because we haven't updated our beliefs.
Right.
We haven't reevaluated things. We've taken some of those things to be procedural. So we just move through the world like it's true. So, you know, that person who moves through the world like I am unlovable is a truth. Think about how much that affects their entire, every interaction they have, everything they say yes or no to.
Like, y'all, that was me, right? 100%. It shows up everywhere.
It shows up everywhere. Well, because now your entire worldview is underlaid by I am unlovable. And that becomes, cognitive behavioral therapy would call that a core belief. You know, there's different languages for different therapies, but it's all the same idea, you know. Emotion-focused therapy, which I'm also a big fan of, would call it the unmet need, and Gestalt would call it the figure. It doesn't actually matter what we call it, but the idea is there's something that has become truth that has not been checked out and not been reevaluated and not been updated. So with Gestalt therapy, we are bringing stuff that has become automated into awareness so that people can, oh, wow, this is where it was built. This is how it was maintained. And this is where it is now. And let me hold that next to my experiences here. And look, does this actually fit? Is this still my value? Is this still my experience? Like, what is it like here and now holding this there and then message? So the idea is to start making things on automatic so that you can reevaluate it, so that you can make more adaptive, healthy choices, whatever those choices are.
Right.
And I like that about our model, because about the Gestalt model, because it really allows the person to be the expert on what they do next. So for me, it's actually a very inclusive therapy, because it's not up to me as the therapist to say, well, you should just go do that, because, you know, that would be maybe my values or my belief, versus they have a whole slew of experiences from their culture, from their family, from their ethnic background, et cetera, that's going to inform what they do. So my job is just to help them, you know, bring the stuff into awareness, to really learn how to attend to what their body's telling them, what their emotions are telling them. And then also, what are those external factors or those rules that you've learned? And when you have all of that and you can see all of it, then you can make more adaptive choices, whatever they are.
So I'm curious, like, I want to bring in the sort of joy piece, right? We've definitely talked about attachment, and that's related to joy, right? Like love is related to joy. But I know in my experience and people that I've talked to who are not trained psychologists, clinical psychologists, I know there's this relationship between like joy can sometimes feel painful when we have unprocessed trauma, right? That it's just too much or too hard. And I'd love to hear a bit more about that from your perspective.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, there might be a risk to allowing oneself to feel joy because joy requires somebody to be unguarded. Joy requires the nervous system to be relaxed. There's a couple of different nervous system responses. There's a theory called polyvagal theory. It's by this guy, Stephen Porges. And he talks about like different levels of arousal in the nervous system. And in order to feel happiness, contentment, joy, you have to be in what's called ventral vagal, meaning that you're not hypervigilant. You're not scanning the environment right. for safety. You're not doing all these other processes. You know, it's just I'm available to feel the sunlight on my skin. I'm available to take in the love of my partner. I'm available to, you know, to really eat this bite of incredibly delicious chocolate cake without the thoughts of, oh, what am I going to have to do to compensate for this cake later? You know, all this right. ways that we interrupt our joy with beliefs about who we should be and what we must do. So I think the reason why some folks who have significant trauma histories have a difficult time getting to joy is because it requires that suspension of vigilance. And
yeah.
And, you know, I think something important to say here too, is that the people who are traumatized, like you're not picking these reactions.
Yeah.
They're so automatic. They're in your deep limbic system. They're not in your frontal lobe where you have some agency. You can't talk yourself out of a trauma response. You can't talk yourself out of vigilance. You know, you have to work with the body systems and, you know, be patient and even work with those parts of you that are trying to protect you with the vigilance. Like, that's why I'm saying like the intentions are good. Like it's like usually those responses are protective or defensive of you.
Right.
And it's hard to tell those parts to stand down because they're like, how can I stand down? If I stand down, you're going to get hurt. So I think that's why some people have a difficult time really settling into contentment and joy and happiness and those that range of emotions, because it requires something that's kept you alive and safe at some point to stand down.
Yeah. And I just thinking about my own experience with all of this and feeling like, you know, not consciously feeling that sense of hypervigilance. It's not like I have been going through the world being like, oh my God, I'm going to die all the time. But on some level, at a bodily level, feeling really alert and looking out for threat, especially sort of social emotional threat for me, right? It wasn't violence, but it was like, is this person going to be mean to me? Like, is somebody going to tease me at any time? Like, reflecting on it in this moment, given my developmental experience, I spent a lot of my adulthood walking through the world really hypervigilant that like somebody was going to tease me, was going to be mean to me. And yeah, that really interrupts my capacity to enjoy a moment. If part of me is always like waiting for somebody to say something mean or to be sarcastic or to correct my behavior, like I can't access the like relaxation necessary to be like, I'm having a good time and everything's fine.
Yes. And yeah, exactly. And again, think about how it reinforces, because my guess is some of the interactions you have in the world are people being snarky or mean, or, you know, especially if you go on the internet and you see some kind of like political
right.
conversation explosion.
Anything.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, there you do have people being mean or being unkind, and that part's a seat and it has a confirmation bias and it continues to reinforce. And what it does is it doesn't give you the ability to discriminate and to be curious about, is this a person who I can trust or is this a person who I can't? It just tells you don't trust anybody. And that's what makes it really hard. And again, if you think about it, its intentions are good. Like if you think about offense does two things, right? Offense can keep bad things out, which is a good function, but it also keeps whatever's inside isolated. So when we have those barriers, So when we have those barriers up, they're super useful because they keep us safe, but they also keep us isolated. They also keep us distant, and they continue to perpetuate those feelings of abandonment, isolation, loneliness, all those things that people want to reach out and attach so that they don't feel those feelings, but they also want to feel safe. And one of the hardest concepts I have to work through with people is you can't be safe and be connected at the same time. Like you can't, I mean, you can have that with somebody you've established that with in moments, but what I'm saying is like, you cannot be connected without the risk. Like you can't do that.
Right.
So you have to risk letting somebody in. And my guess is even if you find the best partner in the world who you're really connected with, like sometimes they're going to be a jerk and sometimes they're going to hurt you.
I'm mostly giggling at that because I adore Steph's husband. And
who I really have an amazing relationship with. And sometimes we piss each other off, which is like totally, totally healthy in a relationship.
Like he's great and he can be a butt, like as is true of all of us, right?
As is true of all of us.
We're not all.
I want to say like part of his love language is like practical joking and shit giving. That's what I want to say. So it's a very consensual thing. But I mean, but it's right. Like I also am somebody who grew up in a chaotic environment. And I'm also somebody who's had to do a lot of my own healing work. I've done my own EMDR, my own therapy. I've done something really great called neurofeedback. I've done tapping. You know, I've really done a lot of these very healing things that have healed so much of my attachment wounding. And it's allowed me to really let down those fences for close others, you know, my husband and Kate, you know, including you.
Yeah.
You know, and some of these other really close people. And even though we might occasionally push a button or hurt each other, offend each other, there's enough understanding that I can work with the part of me that says, you should ghost this person, never talk to them again. I can say like, thank you so much for that information and letting me know that this is something that hurts me, but like, it's okay. Like, let's look, I'm this age with this person now. And, you know, I can lean into the relationship and have a repair. So it's okay to have that mess. Like, that's how I work with it. It's not like that message goes away. It's just, I work with it more adaptively now. Like, hey buddy, thank you for that advice to keep myself safe. And let's look at our current setting and see if I actually need that drastic of a response, which, you know, usually you don't.
Right. And like, likewise, like you are the one of the people that I feel safest with in the world. Right.
I know.
My heart just grew real big in that moment.
Little emo.
And me too. And like that took time, you know?
And repair. You and I've had rupture and repair over the, you know, 2 decades we've been friends. And
especially because we met when I was like drunky McDrunky pants. Like and you hung out with me through that. But then I got sober and our relationship really deepened after that because I had a lot more self-awareness and I think in the vein of this conversation, it wasn't until I got sober that I started cultivating that capacity to sort of turn within, and cultivating that capacity to turn within and check in with myself also provided me the capacity to like become more aware of how my behavior impacted other people.
If I can speak a little bit, because I think some people who are sober or have a really similar experience to you, and I'm going to speak generally, not about you specifically, but if you think about a nervous system that's been dysregulated and can't feel safe with people and can't let its guard down, you know, think of what a solution, you know, I'm doing air quotes right now because people can't see me, what a solution something like alcohol would be to try to regulate a nervous system, to try to connect, to try to get other needs met that can't otherwise get met when your trauma part is running rampant and being hypervigilant.
Oh my God. Right. Like that's why I got stoned all the time, was because I didn't know how to like being around. Oh my God. Yeah. I'm just having this moment of I would get drunk or stoned in order to be around people because my system was always worried that people were going to be mean to me. And so getting drunk or getting stoned let that inhibition sort of get quieter so that I could try to connect with people and try to like have fun without having that sort of like constant fear at the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I have a lot of compassion for folks who have addiction histories, eating disorders, self-harm, lots of suicidal ideation, because all of these things have something in common. They are an answer, again, quotes, to a problem. And that problem is a dysregulated nervous system. So these behaviors are ways that the nervous system can get needs met that were not met in their environment that should have been met. And they weren't. So this is a way to self-regulate. And that's one of the reasons why I think when you treat an eating disorder, when you treat addiction, when you treat somebody who has, you know, maybe like what we call a borderline process or a suicidal ideation process, is that you're treating trauma. I really genuinely believe that. And because if you just get rid of the alcohol, if somebody just stops drinking or they just stop their eating disorder behaviors, you know, it's that idea of the dry drunk where they're still doing a lot of the dysregulated processes. They're just abstaining. And I've seen many people recover, like they stop drinking alcohol, but then they develop an eating disorder or then they, some other thing that is another way to regulate this nervous system dysregulation. And it's interesting for me because my perspective isn't just like, let's get you sober, although that's necessary. It's let's get you sober, but let's also work with the part of you that never learned how to trust an attachment, that never learned how to, you know, be safe in an environment that's really looking out for you, that's really trying to keep you safe, but doesn't know how. So that's why I'm saying it's got a good intention. It's really trying to defend you, protect you, all these kinds of things, but it's doing so in a really maladaptive way.
Yeah.
Good intentions, bad methodology.
Yeah, right. Oh, man. Steph, this is so good. This has been so good. And picking up on what you just touched on, like in the 12-step rooms, like we talk about like alcohol, drugs, et cetera, are just a symptom, right? It like that we take those away and then there's all the stuff that was driving us to that. And that's what the 12 steps work around. And also I'm a big fan of 12 steps plus therapy because of all the stuff that we've talked about, right? Is that there's a body level processing that needs to happen to really unlock the trauma and really be able to show up differently in the world outside of our cognitive thinking. Yeah. Right. That like I can do my step work. I can talk to things. I can do all of the self-help books and write things down. But until for me, I got into the like body unhooking of those autonomic responses. It wasn't until I really did that work that I started to be able to access more joy and more capacity to trust that the people in my life who say they love me do love me and to embrace that really fully. And so I just like three cheers for therapy, three cheers for like dealing with our trauma. And then if to, you know, get on my little settling is bullshit soapbox that like if we want to really experience joy in our lives, like we got to do the work.
So we have a saying in Gestalt therapy: what gets in the way of the work is the work. And what I mean by that is if you're wanting joy and you're wanting to cultivate joy, you have to work with what's getting in the way and interrupting the joy. So my thought is if somebody's like, I really want to be more content, happy, joyful, then I say, well, what's getting in the way of that happening? And oftentimes it's a trauma response. So my thought is if you work through the trauma response, if you learn what your body's telling you, if you learn how to work with those processes rather than against those processes, then that interruption can start to ease up and it can give you more permission to access joy. But you can't just get to, you can't just say, I'm going to go to more parties or I'm going to go like, you'll have spikes of happiness. Happiness is actually, I want to say like kind of easy to get to, like spikes of like moments where you feel good, not for everybody, but contentment and joy, which I think of as a more sustained experience, you know, that I think you can achieve only if you're working with the interrupters, working with them, not against them. A lot of people will say, tell that voice to go away or make that thing stop. And I'm like, no, like it's doing something for you. It was built at an important time in your life. It was actually probably something you needed to survive at some point. So you know, killing it, divorcing it, murdering it off, all those kinds of things. That's actually not helpful. It's, what are you trying to tell me, buddy? Like, what are you telling me about my environment and my needs? Like, what are you? And then sometimes you can say, okay, thank you. You can sit back down now. And sometimes you say, oh, you're right. I actually do need to pay attention to this and I need to protect myself. But the idea is you work with those parts and those messages rather than against them. So that's my answer is, trauma interrupts joy, and it does so well-intentioned. And in order to achieve more joy, you work with those responses and you take care of the part of you that learned how to adjust to a chaotic environment.
Yeah. So how do you determine like what's actually right for me versus what's the trauma response? Like how do I kind of cultivate that awareness?
It's a good question. There's definitely no one size fits all. But what I would say is to start getting very curious about your experience. Remember, we do so many things that are procedural or automatic because that's just what happens. You know, when we first learn to drive, our hands are at 10 and 2 and we're checking our mirrors and we're really attentive, right? But then, a couple of years into driving, sometimes you get to your destination, you're like, oh, I don't even remember. Like, I wasn't even paying attention. I was listening to my audiobook or whatever. Yeah. And that's what our brains do. Our brains automate things. So the idea is if you have a response that feels like that doesn't fit here, or why did I say that? Or hang on a second, I like this person. Why am I avoiding them? Is to start to get really curious. Curiosity is your best friend. Okay, what am I noticing? Like, oh, there's a pit in my stomach. What do I know about this pit in my stomach? Like, what is this familiar from? What is it telling me? You know, what's the emotion? Oh, the emotion is fear. Oh, what am I afraid of? Like, am I actually afraid of this person or am I afraid of something else? And does it belong with that person at this time, or is it something else? You know, if there's a message of get away, hang on, get away from who? This person that I know, that I love? Like, I'll use an example. Like, if I have a reaction of get away from Kate, I know Kate. Kate's like a sister to me. I love her so much. What's going on that came up for me? And
then, yeah, I mean, either I farted or it's a trauma response.
It could be both, Kate.
Right.
But so even though I know we're joking here, but like if you farted and we were in the same place, that would be an adaptive action because it has to do with something that is happening in the here and now. Like, oh God, Kate, like, lay off the keys. Hang on a second. But if you didn't fart and you're just sitting there smiling at me and telling me how much you love being my friend and I have a get away from this response, that's probably something old. That's probably something that was built there. And then it has nothing to do with Kate, has nothing to do with me at this age in this friendship. Mm-hmm. So my offer to people is get very curious. And if you need guidelines for how to do that, what's going on in my body, what's going on in my emotions, meaning labeling an emotion, and what's going on in my thoughts. And if you can get those three pieces of information, you've got a lot of data to start letting you know, does this belong here and now, or is that old stuff from there and then?
Yeah. Okay. And so what if I farted, you have that response, you get in, you like, you're aware of like, oh, I'm in a trauma response. Like this isn't related to the here and now. Then what? Like, how do we take care of ourselves around that?
I think it's one of those things where it's like when this thing happened in the past with another person, the outcome was really bad. But when this, but I need to know if this is happening with this person, is this something that can have a different outcome? Can I trust that it might be different with this other person? So, you know, I know we use the fart example and it's hilarious, but I'm trying to think of something that's a little bit more.
Well, so we're on a date. And like, or, you know, we've been going out for a while and I say, I love you for the first time and you have a reaction and you know, it's like disproportionate to
perfect example
that. Yeah.
And then
well,
I think we need to be kind to ourselves. And then I think it's also really important that we let the other person know enough of what's going on. Mm. You know, you can say something like, I hear you and I believe that you are sincere because you want to check. Do I believe that they mean what they're saying? Even if you don't have a good reaction to it, can I believe that they are sincere is actually a good question to ask yourself. So I hear what you're saying. I believe you, but I'm having a really big response and I don't think it's about you. I think it's about me. I need a minute. Mm-hmm. And there's that sense of, so I see you and I'm not abandoning you, but I have to take care of what's going on with me over here, you know, and that's actually not an uncommon thing to happen is people will have those big responses and then they don't know what to do and they feel like they have to stop themselves. Oh, you pretend like you're not upset, you know, smile and say it back, right. Which is an appease response, by the way, that just say what the person wants to hear and like just to protect yourself. But you can ask for a minute, you know, asking for a minute to take a breath and say, what's going on here? And you can say, you know what? The last person who told me that they loved me was really abusive and my body's just reacting. And I know that that doesn't belong with you, but it might take me a minute to be able to adjust to that with you. So, but it's we don't want to arrest our body responses. We don't want to, you know, cut them off. I mean, there'll be times where that's important, right? Like if you're about to go into an exam, you know, if you're a student, you're going to an exam, sometimes you need to be like, hey, I see you, buddy. Take a breath. I'm going to put you over here and I'll deal with you when I'm done with the exam. Like sometimes it's okay to do that. But I always say like acknowledge and set aside, not suppress. You know, and when I say acknowledge and set aside, actually bring it back out when you can. Don't like, because when people suppress or when they, you know, push, then we see all kinds of anxiety disorders and all kinds of other stuff. Like the more you.
Yeah. Like it comes out sideways, right? It shows up at some point. Like if we throw it in the closet and don't ever try to let it out again, like it's going to be like banging. It's going to be getting under the doors. It's going to show up in ways that really don't serve us, at least in my
experience. It shows up in all kinds. Well, it shows up in ways like that we think about with, you know, maladaptive action, right? Like, I'm screaming at you because you told me you love me. But it also shows up in health outcomes. I mean, folks that we see with a lot of these kind of chronic illnesses or autoimmune diseases like fibromyalgia or things like that, a lot of them have trauma histories. And my guess is that they had dysregulated nervous systems that never got a chance to resettle.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it really does come out sideways. So people who try to just lock that stuff down and never look at it, like they pay price for it. But there's lots of good work out there now. You mentioned Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score. It's a pretty great book for that. There's I really like a lot of stuff by Peter Levine, who does somatic experiencing. So he's another author who talks a lot about like letting the body inform and how to work with the body. Mm-hmm. Some of those books are meant more for professionals, but there are books that are more for the general population. I think one of them is called Waking the Tiger, which is for like, you know, anybody.
Yeah. And I've been plugging this, but I'll plug it again just as an inroad to this. The kind of Oprah Winfrey book, What Happened to You, is a really accessible conversation about trauma and like what we've been talking about.
Yes. So that book is Oprah Winfrey and I think he's a neuroscientist named Bruce Perry. And
thank you for remembering his
name. I love Bruce Perry. He does the neurosequential model. Yeah. He's amazing. So I'm like, my whole world is this trauma world.
Yeah.
So Bruce Perry is amazing. He does something called the neurosequential model and he works a lot with CPTSD, complex PTSD. And his books are really, he's got other books too. They're really amazing. But he has a phrase that I like that's name it to tame it, which is if you can name your emotions or name what's going on somatically and you can kind of take some ownership of it, it can actually like settle something. Oh, there's that pit in my stomach and that pit in my stomach is about fear. And then normally when you can do that, you go, oh, and there's like a something interacts when you can kind of marry your understanding with your body sense. And I can't cite it for anybody, but I also like feel it to heal it. So I have to actually feel what's going on in my body to let it heal.
100%. Yeah. Oh, Steph, this has been gorgeous. Thank you so much. I cannot wait to edit this episode and give it to the world as a gift that it is. As we wind down, I would love to know what brings you joy.
I am a very relational person. I really deeply care about the people in my life. So quality time is my love language. That brings me a lot of joy. And again, really grateful for the trauma work that I've done because I can get into that ventral vagal state we were talking about. And my favorite thing in the whole world to do, and you know this about me, is to have really good food with my favorite people. So that's probably one of my most joyous things. It's like, let's go get something really yummy and let's have quality time and have one of those long, leisuring meals where we linger over the table and, you know, we have really good things and we just connect. So really connected contact with other people for good food is probably my favorite thing in the world.
Well, we weren't eating, but I feel like we ticked part of that box. This conversation has been so joyful for me. Where can people find you?
A couple of different places. So I have a group private practice in Claremont, California. We're called Goldsmith Psychological Services, and that's our website, just goldsmithpsychologicalservices.com. If you are a mental health professional and you're interested in Gestalt training, GATLA.org, GATLA.org, we have an online program, we have an in-person program, and we also have a summer residential every year. I'm actually just about to leave for Bulgaria for our summer residential, which is really great because that way
we
work with professionals from like dozens of different countries all over the world. It's a really rich experience.
Yeah, and Steph's going to Kazakhstan next year to train people. How fucking delightful and cool is that?
It's really amazing.
Yeah,
traveling the world doing Gestalt therapy is like a dream. I can't believe I just got back from Australia a couple months ago working with folks there. So it's just like really pleasurable, joyful thing to do, to go come teach other people to do this thing that I think is just so healing and so amazing. So GATLA.org, GoldsmithPsychologicalServices.com. Those are probably the best places to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Steph. This has been beautiful. You're beautiful. Your family's beautiful. The work you're doing in the world is beautiful. Everything is beautiful.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for having me as a guest. It's been fun to sit across from you this way. You know, we've known each other forever. So this has been fun.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please help me grow the podcast by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing it with anyone you think would benefit from hearing it too. Your support means the world to me. If you'd like to get updates about new episodes, posts, and offerings, please visit settlingisbullshit.com to subscribe to my newsletter. You can also find information there about working with me one-on-one to build your most amazing life. Until next time, remember that I believe in you and that you are fucking awesome.